Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Serial Killer Tuesdays. I've decided to dress up as the most dangerous serial killer of all time for Halloween. I'm super excited because that means I can just wear what I normally do every day. I'm so incredibly happy with how much traction my podcast has gained in the last few weeks. We went from getting maybe 60 downloads every episode, which would take a few weeks to acquire, to at least 100 downloads every episode in only a few days. I really can't find the words to express what that means to me. At the start of this, I was just hoping my friends and family would tune in. But it has grown so much bigger than that. My goal is to hit 2,000 downloads total by January 1st, 2021. I'm already at 1,400 and I have no doubts in my mind that we can't make this happen. Thank you, Serial supporters, for your continued listenership and support for this podcast. As you may know by now, at the end of each episode every week, I like to give my favorite podcast a shout-out, so make sure you stay until the end for that. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at SKTPodcast to keep up to date on everything podcast-related. Want to help support the show? All it would take is the price of a single cup of coffee. I know a lot of people can't financially afford a monthly subscription to Patreon or something like that. A one-time donation is so much easier, and it comes with perks. If you graciously decide my podcast is one worth supporting, you can request any serial killer, cult leader, hitman, whatever you prefer, to be discussed on this show. And, or, if you have a podcast or YouTube channel, I will give you an exclusive shout-out on my podcast. I will also leave you a rating, review, comment, like, and subscribe. It's the least I can do. Check out buymeacoffee.com/SKTPodcast to buy me a cup of liquid energy. Because, as we all know by now, I fucking need it. But never feel obligated to do so. Just the fact that you tune in every week is always enough for me. Tonight, we will be looking at the Butcher Baker, Robert Hansen, and the Gorilla Killer, Earl Nelson. As always, I'm going to issue you a warning. The things you are about to hear may be graphic and disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. I come from a family of avid hunters. My brother, many of my uncles, and many family friends go duck hunting, deer hunting, and even bring home the occasional turkey for Thanksgiving. I know many animal rights activists despise it, but let me hit you with a few facts. I majored in what's called animal management when I was in college, so I took many classes devoted to learning the ins and outs of wildlife. Did you know that the Pittman-Robertson Act puts an 11% tax on the sales of firearms, firearm ammunition, archery equipment, and arrow components, and distributes it to state governments for wildlife projects? It's crazy to think, when you look behind the scenes, how much the sport of hunting actually puts back into preserving the animals we all know and love. However, the case I present to you tonight isn't what we'd call good sportsmanship. This isn't about preserving our own backyard. It's about the brutality one man took out against his prey. And by prey, I mean vulnerable, defenseless women. He took his love of hunting and mixed it with a deadly desire to murder humans. Submitted for the approval of the Midnight Society, I present to you the Butcher Baker, Robert Hansen. Robert Hansen was born February 15, 1939, in Estherville, Iowa. From an early age, Robert's Danish immigrant father cast a very dark shadow over him. He was a domineering figure in Robert's life, and often drove him away, leading Robert down a path of solace in learning how to hunt. His father cracked down on him and demanded he follow in his footsteps of becoming a baker, which Robert did later on in his life. Troubled with a tumultuous home life, Robert also found no peace at school either. He suffered from a severe stutter and horrible acne. He even later described his face as one giant pimple and was bullied relentlessly throughout his formative years. He was painfully shy and closed off, especially toward women. He would often be shunned by girls his age, and this is where experts believe he began nursing his fantasies of cruel revenge against them. Robert went on to graduate high school in 1957 and enlisted in the U.S. Army Reserves for 1 year until he was eventually discharged. After that, he took a job as an assistant drill instructor at the police academy in Pocahontas, Iowa. He then went on to marry his younger girlfriend in the summer of 1960. The first of many crimes began on December 7, 1960, where he burned down a Pocahontas County school bus garage as kind of revenge for his tormented years in school. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison, but only served 20 months. While serving his sentence, Robert underwent a psychiatric evaluation where he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder with schizophrenic episodes. The psychiatrist also noted that Robert had an infantile personality and was obsessed with revenge against all of those who wronged him in the past. Robert's wife filed for divorce while he was still incarcerated. Over the next several years, Robert would be jailed numerous times for petty theft. After marrying for a second time in 1963 and having two children, the family moved to Anchorage, Alaska in 1967, where Robert was well-liked by his neighbors and even managed to set several hunting records. He had his own plane that he would take out into the secluded wilderness to get to the best hunting spots. Many locations most hunters weren't privy to. The good times didn't last long, however. In December of 1971, Robert found himself on the wrong side of the law yet again. He was arrested and charged with the rape and the attempted rape and abduction of both a prostitute and housewife. He pled no contest to assault with a deadly weapon, and the rape charge against the prostitute was dropped in a plea deal. Robert was sentenced to 5 years in prison, but only served 6 months of his sentence before being placed in a work release program and released to a halfway house. In 1976, Robert was again arrested for stealing a chainsaw from an Anchorage department store. He was sentenced to 5 years, but as these things normally go, the Alaskan Supreme Court reduced his sentence. It was at this point that Robert let his feelings of rage and inadequacy boil past his limits. He went in search of prey that he deemed unworthy of compassion and empathy. He projected his morbid feelings of anguish and rejection onto women, women he thought society wouldn't miss if they were gone. It was easy to lure in most prostitutes. Robert knew they would never turn down the opportunity to make money. He would often whisk them away in his private plane and offer large sums of cash that they couldn't refuse. Once they felt comfortable with his presence, he would kidnap and rape them. He would put them on his plane and fly them out to his hidden cabin in Nick River Valley. He would strip them of their clothes and gave them a head start to flee into the woods. From there, Robert would track down the naked women, using his skills as a hunter and a marksman. He would either shoot them down with his rifle or gut them with his hunting knife. The first body was discovered in July of 1980 on Eklutna Lake Road in a shallow grave. The woman remained unidentified because of the state of decomposition and being torn apart by local wildlife. The second body to be found was that of 24-year-old topless dancer Joanne Messina, also in July of 1980. The body was found in a gravel pit, and her body was so badly decomposed, investigators couldn't find any useful evidence. The third victim was 24-year-old Sherry Morrow. She was discovered buried in a shallow grave on the bank of the Nick River in September of 1982. Despite being found fully clothed, she was shot fatally 3 times in the back with no bullet holes in her clothes. Investigators deduced that she was naked when she was murdered and then redressed before being dumped. The next victim was also found on the banks of the Nick River in September of 1982. The body of Paula Golding, a 17-year-old topless dancer, was found in identical conditions to that of Sherry. She was shot in the back while she was naked and redressed afterwards. The next victim wasn't discovered until April of 1984. The body belonged to 23-year-old Sue Luna, and it is unclear when she disappeared or had been killed. But, just like previous victims, Robert stripped her naked, hunted her down, and shot her to death. In June of 1983, Robert kidnapped 17-year-old Cindy Paulson after he offered her $200 to perform oral sex on him. She agreed and got into his car, and that's when Robert pulled a gun on her. He drove her back to his house, where he kept her captive, intending on raping and murdering her. He chained Cindy to a pole in his basement by her neck. After he woke up from a nap, he drove her to the local airfield to get his plane ready to fly to Nick River. While Robert was distracted, Cindy managed to hop out of the driver's side door and make a mad dash to freedom. With Robert in hot pursuit, she was able to flag down a truck driver, Robert Yount. Shocked by Cindy's appearance, he let her in and drove her to a nearby motel so she could call her boyfriend. While she was doing that, Yount called the police to report the incident. Cindy gave her version of events down at the police station and then brought Robert in for further questioning. He told the police that she was merely a disgruntled prostitute looking to bag more money from him. Because of his meekness and alibi from his friend, they ended up having to let him go. With bodies beginning to pile up, Anchorage investigators were finding it difficult to pin down a suspect. They searched down every lead and tip, but all of it amounted to nothing. They brought FBI profile specialists in to get an idea of what individual they should be looking out for. The profiler described the killer as follows: an experienced hunter, history of rejection by women, low self-esteem, may have a stuttering problem, and was likely to keep souvenirs from each murder, most likely jewelry. It was almost as if they accompanied Robert to his crimes. That's how accurate of a profile they rendered. Armed with this new information, the head investigator decided that Robert fit so closely to what the profiler had described that he was worth taking a second look at. Using the profile from the FBI and Cindy's testimony about her abduction, police were able to secure a search warrant for Robert's home, plane, and car. October 27, 1983, investigators found a collection of jewelry, later identified as belonging to several of the victims. They also found a large supply of firearms with an aviation map littered with small red X marks. He was promptly arrested. Robert denied any involvement in the murders despite the overwhelming evidence against him. Eventually, however, the pressure proved to be too much for him and he caved. At first, he blamed the victims, telling investigators that he was justified in killing them. But that excuse didn't work either. A little while later, Robert confessed that he had been murdering women since 1971. Robert agreed to a plea deal to avoid the death penalty. He would plead guilty to 4 murders, help investigators locate other victims, and explain what the red X marks on his map meant. Robert showed investigators to 17 different grave sites, but refused to show them the last 3 marks on his map. Police suspect that these are the burial sites of 17-year-old Megan Emmerich, 23-year-old Mary Thill, and a 3rd unidentified victim. By pleading guilty, Robert was convicted and sentenced to 461 years in prison without the possibility of parole. Robert Hansen died August 21, 2014, from ongoing health conditions while still serving his sentence in Lemon Creek Prison. He was 75 years old. I can only imagine what must have been going through those women's minds as they were running naked through the woods, fearing for their lives. Being taken away from everything you've ever known, just to be hunted down like an animal. How humiliating it must have been to be treated as nothing more than a target in a twisted game of cat and mouse. Nothing fills me with more dread than knowing what primal fear they went through before their untimely demise. But there is always a silver lining. At least justice has been served. Their killer was caught and faced judgment for what he did to them. When you lead the kind of lifestyle that these women did, you leave yourself at risk to fall victim to sadistic, dangerous people. Even worse than that, because of this lifestyle, you may be forgotten about or swept under the shelf because society doesn't want to acknowledge that prostitution exists. As if you're not worthy of justice. Regardless of what kind of life you lead, you have the right to exist. No one can murder you unjustly and get away with it. Thankfully, this man was caught. But what about the millions of other cold cases? We have to keep fighting for those that have no voice. Your occupation doesn't mean you don't deserve justice or your loved ones shouldn't receive closure. It just means we need to work harder to get the job done. Before we move on, I would just like to give a quick shout out to my sponsor. This next killer I have for you tonight is one that has set many records in the early 20th century, and yet, not many people know about him. He was the first serial killer to gain widespread media coverage in American history, long before H.H. Holmes and Ted Bundy. His confirmed murder count was the highest for nearly 5 decades, until Dean Corll's crimes were discovered in early 1970. If you're interested in hearing more about Dean Corll, he is featured in an episode of this podcast, episode 4, I believe. He was also the first serial sex murderer in American history as well. To top it all off, Alfred Hitchcock's film Shadow of a Doubt was inspired by this killer's murder spree. Often referred to as the Gorilla Killer because of his hulking stature and the brutal nature of his killings, law enforcement also couldn't help but notice the similarities between him and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. At first, he appeared kind and approachable to gain his victim's trust, only to switch into a ferocious beast with nothing but murder on his mind. Tonight, I present to my listeners, Earl Nelson. Earl Nelson was born on May 12th, 1897 in San Francisco, California. By only the age of 2, Earl became an orphan. Both of his parents died not long after contracting syphilis. He was sent to live with his devoutly religious grandmother shortly after his parents' passing. From an early age, Earl exhibited very morbid and odd behavior. This got him kicked out of elementary school at the age of 7. His odd behaviors included talking to people who weren't there, watching female family members undress, and being sent to school in fresh, clean clothes, only to come home dirty and disheveled, as if he swapped his normal clothes with a homeless person's. When he was 10 years old, he was struck by a streetcar while riding his bicycle, which put him in a coma for 6 days. When he awoke, his behavior only seemed to worsen, becoming increasingly erratic. He also suffered from memory loss and severe headaches. As a teenager, Earl began experimenting with sex by visiting various bars and brothels, and at one point contracted a venereal disease. His life of crime began when he was 18 years old. His first prison sentence came in 1915 when he was arrested for breaking and entering. He was paroled in September of 1916, only to end up back behind bars in March of 1917. He served 6 months of that sentence, was released, and then got arrested again for burglary. After 5 months into that sentence, he escaped from jail, and authorities never bothered to look for him. This wouldn't be the last time he made his escape from an institution meant to keep him inside. Over the next several years, he would be placed in different mental hospitals. The first time was because he kept enlisting in the military, only to desert his post after a few weeks. After enlisting and deserting every branch under different names, Navy officers decided to put him in a mental hospital for further evaluation in 1918. The psychiatrist who treated Earl said he did not appear to be homicidal, violent, or destructive, even though he spoke at great length about having paranoid delusions and hallucinations. He escaped the hospital on 3 separate occasions, and after the 3rd escape, the staff stopped looking for him. He was discharged from the Navy in May of 1919. On May 19, 1921, Earl entered a home in San Francisco under the guise of being a plumber. He had been stalking 12-year-old Mary Summers and planned to molest her once he got the opportunity. When she started screaming, her older brother quickly came to her aid, and Earl fled the scene. He was caught and again sent to another mental hospital. He escaped twice before being discharged in 1925. After being discharged from the military and before his molestation attempt, Earl worked as a janitor at St. Mary's Hospital and met 60-year-old Mary Martin. The two got married in August of 1919, but the marriage deteriorated fast. Mary would later state that being married to Earl was like a living nightmare. He had bizarre sexual demands, flew into fits of jealous rage, suffered from religious delusions, and was becoming increasingly violent. They divorced in February of 1920. Shortly after being released from the mental hospital in early 1926, Earl embarked on his murder spree that would shake the nation. His first victim was 60-year-old Clara Newman, a wealthy landlady in San Francisco. On February 26, 1926, he pretended to be interested in a property she was renting. He entered the building and strangled Clara to death, raped her dead body, and hid her in the empty apartment. On March 2nd, Earl entered the home of 63-year-old Laura Beale in San Jose. He strangled her with a silk cord so tightly that it was embedded into the flesh of her neck. On June 26th, in San Francisco, Earl raped and strangled 63-year-old Lillian St. Mary, and 2 weeks later in July, he strangled 53-year-old Ollie Russell in her boarding house. He raped Ollie after murdering her, and on August 16th, the husband of 52-year-old Mary Nisbet found her body in the empty apartment building that they owned. She, like the previous victims, was strangled, then raped. A witness to this crime described the suspicious man as having long arms and huge hands. This led to the nickname, the Gorilla Killer. Earl left for Oregon to continue his ruthless killings of middle-aged landladies. In Portland, on October 19th, he raped and killed 35-year-old Betty Withers. Her body was found inside a steamer trunk in her attic. The next day, Earl murdered 59-year-old Virginia Grant and stuffed her body behind the furnace in her basement. 2 days later, landlady Mabel Fluke was reported missing, only to be found a few days later in her attic, strangled to death with her own scarf. After his rampage in Oregon, Earl made his way back to San Francisco, where he raped and murdered 56-year-old Anna Edmonds on November 18th. The next day, a pregnant 28-year-old was showing her house to potential buyers when she was attacked. Fortunately, her and her baby survived and was able to give police a full description of her attacker. On November 23rd, Earl traveled to Seattle, Washington, where he raped and murdered Florence Monks. On November 29th, he again traveled back to San Francisco and murdered Blanche Myers. Police were able to lift several fingerprints from the scene. Earl was constantly on the move, murdering woman after woman across many other states. On December 23rd, in Iowa, 41-year-old Amira Bernard was found raped and murdered inside her home. Earl had used her own shirt to strangle her. On December 27th, in Kansas City, 23-year-old Bonnie Pace was also found raped and strangled to death in her home. The day after, Germania Harpin and her 8-month-old son were found in their home. Both had been strangled, and Germania was raped afterward. After a few months' cool-down period, Earl made his way to Philadelphia, where he began raping and murdering once again. On April 27, 1927, he raped and murdered 53-year-old landlady Marie McConnell. A month later, on May 27, he traveled to my hometown of Buffalo, New York, where he rented a room under the alias Charles Harrison from 53-year-old Jenny Rudolph. Her body was found 3 days later under the bed in the room she was renting to Earl. He strangled her and raped her body. On June 1st, in Detroit, Michigan, the bodies of boarding house manager Franny May and boarder Maureen Atorthy were found raped and murdered. 2 days later, 27-year-old Mary Seitzma was killed by Earl in Chicago. Earl's final two victims, Lola Conan, 14 years old, and Emily Patterson, both went missing from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, in June. Emily's husband found her body on the night of June 10th, a few hours after she went missing. She was raped, murdered, and shoved underneath her son's bed. On June 12th, the Winnipeg police conducted a massive search of all boarding houses. During their search, police found the decomposing body of Lola in the room Earl had been staying in. Unlike the other victims, Lola had been severely mutilated. 4 days later, police in Killarney, near Manitoba, stopped a man who fit Earl's description, but was going by the name Virgil Wilson. They took him in for questioning, and while he was waiting, he managed to escape. Earl caught the same train that was being used to transport Winnipeg police officers. He was caught only 12 hours after his escape. Police took pictures of Earl and circulated them around to every police department in America. He was positively identified in both California and Illinois. Winnipeg police sent over his fingerprints to the San Francisco Police Department, where they found matches to fingerprints left behind at several crime scenes. At first, Earl confessed to his crimes to reporters, stating, "I only do my lady killings on Saturday nights," but quickly recanted that statement and claimed that he was innocent. In the U.S., Earl was a wanted man in six cities. He was held in Canada to be tried for the murders of Lola and Emily. His trial began on November 1st, 1927, where 60 people, including his ex-wife, from both the U.S. and Canada, testified against him. On November 5th, 1927, it only took the jury 40 minutes to deliberate and come back with a verdict of guilty. Earl was sentenced to death. In December, he submitted a 30-page document to the Minister of Justice asking for clemency on the grounds of insanity. This appeal was denied. On January 13th, 1928, Earl Nelson was hanged at the Vaughan Street Jail in Winnipeg. His final words were, "I am innocent. I stand innocent before God and man. I forgive those who have wronged me and ask forgiveness of those I have injured. God have mercy. I forgive those who have wronged me." He was only 30 years old. I find it hard to believe so few people know who Earl Nelson is, considering he was the first of his kind. Before Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Ed Gein, John Wayne Gacy, and all other mainstream serial killers became so popular, it was Earl who paved the way. He also cleared the road for future FBI agents to be able to study sex crimes and sexual violence and how much influence it has over other criminal offenders. While he may be a dark stain on our past, he is still vital to studying and understanding how serial killers operate. I'm in no way excusing his actions. He got what he deserved, and the world is much better off without him. But he is a fundamental piece to the puzzle regarding criminal behavior and mental illness. People like him bring us one step closer to unlocking the secrets behind depravity and deviancy. Welcome to my final segment of the evening. I call this the Missing Persons Report, where I visit the FBI website and share a few missing persons cases with my listeners. I feel it's my duty as a serial killer / true crime podcast to get this important information out there. Maybe we can help bring these lost souls home. My first case of the evening, Carla Rodriguez. Date of birth, September 29th, 1992. She would be approximately 28 years old today. Eye color, brown. Hair color, black. race, Hispanic, gender, female, scars and marks. Carla has a small mole above her right eyebrow. Carla Rodriguez was last seen in Las Vegas, Nevada on October 20th, 1999. At the time of her disappearance, she spoke limited English. The FBI is offering a reward of up to $5,000 for information that leads to the whereabouts of Carla Rodriguez. Additional reward money may be available. Anyone with information regarding this case is asked to contact the Las Vegas Division of the FBI at 702-385-1281. Thank you. My second case of the evening, Elijah Moore. Date of birth, November 3rd, 1999. He would be approximately 21 years old today. Height, 5 foot 11 inches. Weight, approximately 200 pounds. Eye color, brown. Hair color, black. Race, black. Gender, male. Scars and marks. Elijah has a burn scar on his left hand. Elijah Moore, from Woodland, California, was reported missing by his mother on Monday, November 6, 2016. Elijah was last seen on Friday, November 4, 2016, the day after his birthday. He attended school and later cashed a check at California Check Cashing located at 115 Main Street in Woodland. According to court documents, one juvenile and three adults were charged with the following alleged crimes: murder, accessory to a felony, kidnapping, and enhancements for use of a deadly weapon, committing multiple murders, and committing a murder during the commission of a kidnapping after the disappearance of Elijah Moore and Enrique Rios. On September 14, 2018, the Yolo County District Attorney's Office announced an individual pleaded no contest to second-degree murder. On November 13, 2018, the Yolo County District Attorney's Office announced one individual was found guilty of one count of first-degree murder, one count of second-degree murder, and one count of kidnapping. On the day of his disappearance, Moore was last seen wearing a black hooded sweatshirt, a yellow shirt, khaki pants, and tan work boots. He also carried a green backpack. The FBI is offering a reward of up to $5,000 for information leading to the location of Elijah Moore. The FBI, Yolo County Sheriff's Office, and Woodland Police Department continue to seek information from the public that would assist in locating Elijah. If you have any information concerning this case, please contact the Woodland Police Department at 530-666-2411 or the Sacramento FBI Field Office at 916-746-7000. Thank you. Well, human friends, it has been an absolute pleasure entertaining you this evening. This episode has turned out to be one of my favorites. I really worked hard on it, and I hope that it shows. Now, it's time for the best part of my podcast, shouting out other podcasts that I know you will really enjoy. Mix and Murder Podcast at Mix Up Murder. Chills, Thrills, and Kills, the podcast, at CTK Pod. And Behind the Screams Podcast at Screams Behind. Make sure you go check them out, follow them on Twitter, leave them a rating and review, and let them know I sent you. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at SKT Podcast so you don't miss anything podcast related. If you can, consider buying me a cup of coffee at buymeacoffee.com/SKT Podcast. All of the money will go toward making a better show for you all to enjoy. I'm even hoping to get to a point where I can take that money every month and donate it back to charities that I believe in. That is something I've always wanted to do. But, as I said before, never feel obligated to do it. Your listenership is more than enough for me. On the next episode, I'm going to surprise my listeners. I'm not telling anyone who I'll be discussing next. You'll just have to wait until next Tuesday to find out. Good night, and stay safe.